You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and the big conversation today is restaurants and how they're coping with a very challenging time as regulations to keep us safe are making it difficult, of course, to do business. During the early phases of the pandemic, the federal government stepped forward with some help for those places forced to close. They had some loans called PPP, or the Paycheck Protection Program. And there's been a lot of scrutiny regarding who got these loans and who did not. And now there's some new evidence that shows Black-owned restaurants received a disproportionately small piece of the pie. Jonathan Mays is the editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business Magazine and joins us to discuss his reporting on this issue. And thanks for making time for us this morning, Jonathan.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So your piece points to two main problems, one being a bad data collection at the heart of it, and then the other being historically weak lending to people of color. So let's start first with the overall numbers. How many restaurants got these loans?
Well, that is in terms of the numbers that received $150,000 or more, a total of 49,000 restaurant companies received that amount.
Mm-hmm. And the Black-owned portion of that?
130.
Huh. Out of 49,000, did you say?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, that is that's an undercount. That's a definite undercount. So one of the problems is that 80% of those restaurants didn't even fill out the race question. So, almost certainly going to be, you know, a lot more than 130.
It was just optional when they were applying?
It's just historically the lenders do not really address that question. It has been something that advocates have been pushing for a long time, which is to get a sense of the racial and gender makeup of the businesses to whom they lend money through government programs. And they really haven't done a very good job. They didn't do a good job at all on the PPP fund, as that illustrates. Mm. And so it makes it really difficult to tell how many actually got these numbers. I mean, on this question alone, I mean, I've had people tell me, well, we think that more Black-owned restaurants just didn't fill it out, or maybe more white-owned restaurants didn't fill it out. It was really difficult to tell who did or didn't fill it out. So the best we can judge is based on those who did, and even that number is pathetically low, 1.3% of the businesses that actually did fill out that question.
You also, in your piece, point to the disparity in Black ownership being a problem as well, right?
Yeah, what's difficult to assess is how representative that 1.3% is of the entire restaurant industry. But if you look at overall Black business ownership, it's disproportionately low. So 7% of small businesses are Black owned versus 13% of the population, for instance. That's likely fairly representative of what you see in the restaurant industry, which is generally, if you look at employment numbers and things like that, is generally pretty representative of the population as a whole.
Mm. Which would be then a driving force in the percentages of businesses that got loans.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The other question behind that 1.3% is that a lot of them might have received less than $150,000. And that was the vast majority of PPP loans were to very small businesses. And one belief is that, Black-owned restaurants, are disproportionately smaller restaurants, smaller sized organizations, and then didn't qualify for as much money, and therefore their names weren't on that list that we took a look at. So, so that might be overrepresentative in that particular group, where you might see a lot more Black-owned restaurants there. But again, we don't have that data.
Right. Jonathan, a portion of your piece is titled financial redlining. Can you explain that concept to us? Because we know the concept of redlining when it comes to homes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in simple terms, what they do is what's done is they want a lender will want a borrower to demonstrate that the place they want to open their restaurant or other business in has a lot of foot traffic, or has really good demographic numbers, or things like that. Well, a lot of predominantly Black and minority neighborhoods, you know, are often underserved, certainly in the restaurant space. And how it's been described to me is like a lot of, you know, for instance, you know, they might have only a single grocery store in one of these neighborhoods, or they might not have any grocery store in these neighborhoods. And they might not have the anchor tenants that you see in suburban or other areas where they can have the foot traffic that the restaurant can use to take to the bank to get the loan. So they're going to want, so what ends up happening is a sort of de facto redlining where they end up restricting loans to specific neighborhoods where there are fewer of the retail businesses that a lender is going to want to see.
And I guess ends up happening is then the people that don't need loans, like your McDonald's and your Burger Kings and Jack in the Box, can move into those neighborhoods because they're not being served by smaller mom and pop places because they couldn't qualify for a loan.
Right. Well, I mean, they're still frequently going to need loans, but the bank is going to be more likely to lend to those because they have the backstop of the franchisor in that particular case.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, it depends on the concept, but yeah, usually in a McDonald's or a Burger King case, you know, the lender is just really eager to give those guys a loan and will just always give it to them because Burger King and McDonald's have these brand names behind it. But if you're going to start your own restaurant, and it's really hard to get financing to start up your own restaurant, period. The bank is really going to want a lot of data and information, and they're really going to want to make sure that, you know, in their eyes, the business can succeed. And what ends up happening is that financing becomes a real problem in these neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and it tends to exacerbate a situation where they become food deserts, certainly in the restaurant space, because, you know, you don't get the innovative new restaurants that you might get in other parts of the city.
Yeah. Jonathan Mays is the editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business Magazine. His piece is titled Only 130 Black-Owned Restaurants Received Larger PPP Loans, and you'll find a link to that at capradio.org/insight. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Joining us now to continue our discussion about the intersection of COVID-19 and the restaurant industry is Sacramento Bee restaurant critic Kate Washington. Kate, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so Kate, is the pandemic a good or bad time to be somebody in your position? Does it give you more or less to write about?
Well, I've got a lot of free time, to be honest with you. It's challenging to consider how to evaluate restaurants fairly at this time as a food critic. There's been a lot of people who've written about that question. Some good work came out of the New York Times, the LA Times, Eater, about the responsibilities of a restaurant critic at this time. And I think my view is that it would certainly not be fair to do a traditional review, even if I were, even if I felt comfortable dining in-house in a restaurant, which is not currently available to me. But I have been doing some evaluation of takeout. My colleague Benji Eagle and I at the Bee have are planning a kind of best of takeout roundup coming up soon.
So good. I'm going to look forward to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is your overall take on how the Sacramento restaurant scene is handling the challenges of protecting the public against the coronavirus?
Well, I think there's been a lot of innovation that I'm excited to see. I think it varies really widely by restaurant. It's obviously an unbelievably challenging time. And I think the restaurant industry was already challenged and at a little bit of an inflection point before the pandemic struck, and this obviously has just upended everything. You know, we have a strong dining scene. We have a lot of really innovative restaurateurs who I think have done and are doing a great job of pivoting and working with just incredibly challenging conditions.
Yeah. I want to give listeners a chance to comment or ask a question right now if they want via Twitter with our hashtag AskInsight. Kate is at Washington Kate. I'm at Randall White, and that's Randall, RANDOL. It's an unusual spelling. So at Randall White and at Washington Kate, or the hashtag AskInsight. If you just have some stuff to say about the restaurant scene currently, a question or a comment, feel free to pass it along there on Twitter. So earlier, I noticed big differences in how individual restaurants were going about these protection measures, Kate. In some places that I visited, there's a QR code on the table that you use your phone to scan, and then you order from your phone, and then somebody masked comes out, brings it to you. Everything's sealed. It was sort of an environmental disaster, just all of the different plastic used to coat the food. And then other places I went to, I saw servers without masks, and it was sort of anything goes. That was back in maybe early June. Then we had that sort of bump up in numbers again, and now I am noticing that the couple of places I've been to, they're really stringent about the rules, and everyone needs to be outside. You have to order food if you're having a drink and that sort of thing. So there does seem to be an evolution towards safety.
Yes, and I think that's very heartening to see. I personally am just on a personal level, I'm glad that the orders changed to move toward outdoor dining. I am somebody who lives with somebody with immune suppression, and so I haven't felt comfortable doing dine-in. I've been strictly ordering takeout up to this point, just for myself personally and for my family. I think it's been interesting to see a lot of the change in evolution. Like there are more pop-ups, more private chef services coming up, ghost kitchens starting up. That was a trend that was starting to take off before the pandemic, but hadn't really hit Sacramento. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, potentially delivery services as well, though delivery of food is a vexed question, I think, for restaurants and presents a lot of challenges.
It does, depending on how much the delivery services take and that sort of thing. My husband and I went out to eat on the R Street corridor the other day, and it's funny the things you think about now. We were considering the direction the wind, the breeze was going, as to which table we wanted to choose, and just all, I never. That wasn't something that would have crossed my mind in the past, but we did get what I thought was an ideal table. But it was
Wonderful.
nice.
Where did you go?
We went to Cafe Bernardo, and they have that section of street shut down, and so the tables are all outdoors, and it seems to be working very well. They were filled to the capacity they could, with separation and some tables not being seated and that sort of thing. And the food was terrific. So was the service.
Wonderful. I got Cafe Bernardo takeout a while ago. It was my teenage daughter's birthday, and she wanted Eggs Benedict, so we brought that home for her. Perhaps not the dish that travels the best, but it was the birthday girl's choice. So,
You got to go with that. So,
yeah.
one of your colleagues in the industry, Sonia Sorich at the Sacramento Business Journal, did a piece based on data provided by Yelp that shows 131 restaurants had permanently closed through mid-July. And of course, that number is far from perfect, but it does point out that this is a serious situation. What do you expect to see? How do you expect to see this evolving Sacramento business, Sacramento restaurant scene go forward?
I think that's going to be a very tough question and is going to depend a lot on the duration of the safety measures that we currently have to have in place. You know, obviously bigger players are more able to ride out a longer closure. Places that are better set up for takeout anyway are also better set up to better position to ride that out. You know, a pizza place is going to do better than, for instance, as we were just talking about, a brunch place. But I'm really heartened to see the kind of innovation you're talking about, like on our street with the road closure and able to distance people. I know Pangea and Gunther's have worked together to close off their
That
kind of cul-de-sac
stretch.
Street to have dining out there. I think that outdoor dining was something that was a little bit underutilized in Sacramento, to be honest. I was always a little surprised how few really nice patios we had. So if we can get more restaurants going forward that will, you know, use the beautiful outdoor spaces and lovely evenings that we have when
Tree
the Delta
canopies
Breeze does come in.
Yeah, right.
I think that would be great.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing some of those streets remain closed post-pandemic. Kate, in the short time we have left, I do want to address, since I called for it, a Twitter post from Brian with a Y. He's at Life of Brian. He wants to know what challenges or opportunities do new restaurants have currently? And I was sort of wondering the same thing. Kate, do you foresee, because with all of these restaurants closing, and we know there will be demand there in the future, a lot of new places opening up, and where might those dollars come from? Bay Area?
Well, that's a good question. I can't really speak to the dollars. I know that close to 25 new places have actually opened during the pandemic, and like hats off to them, because that's taking a degree of difficulty and just making it exponential. Mm. You know, Maydoun, the first Persian restaurant on the grid, has recently opened up. Mica opened by alumni of the Cheese Board, the kind of famed pizza place and bread place in Berkeley. A favorite of mine has been Madar, a new Afghan Uzbek fusion street food. And I think, you know, the places that are opening up now and in the immediate future, you know, a lot of them were in the works. It takes a great deal of time to open a restaurant. So places that were in the works, you know, when I've talked to people, they've just said, well, we might as well open. We're still paying rent. I think places have to think carefully about safety issues. Mm-hmm. They have to build out an online platform for things like takeout or delivery if they're going to offer that. But, you know, we're going to have to see more innovation going forward, because one thing that's not going to change is the wish of people to eat food they didn't have to cook themselves, and the wish of cooks and chefs to feed people. And I think, you know, a thing to keep in mind as well is that for chefs and restaurateurs, it's not just about the cooking, it's also about the relationships with the guest and the hospitality.
Right.
Restaurateurs
mm-hmm.
have always had to be nimble, and they'll have to be even more so now.
Right. Kate, I'm going to have to end it there, and I'll allow you to answer your other call. I do want to thank you so much for joining us. And I do want to mention a sad farewell to Espanol in East Sac, which, according to several sources, is Sacramento's oldest operating restaurant. Just couldn't make it through the COVID times. And I've been there on several occasions, and I'm sad to see that go. Espanol in East Sac. Sacramento Bee restaurant critic Kate Washington, thank you again. And still ahead, we always think about what's known as the front of the house, right? When we consider restaurant jobs, you know, the waiters, the bartenders, the hosts. But there are so many other jobs connected to restaurants that mostly go unseen. And we'll delve into one of those in just a couple of minutes. Also, buffets quickly becoming a thing of the past in a town famous for its massive casino buffets. We'll head to Reno to address that topic. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight, Cap Radio's live morning show, where we discuss the issues of the day from several different perspectives. This is, you know, sort of your water cooler or a town square, or get your opinions and voices heard and expressed. I'm your host, Randall White. Today, we've been taking a deep dive into the restaurant industry, really one of the hardest hit by the protection measures put in place by the COVID-19 pandemic. When restaurants are in operation, they need, of course, fresh ingredients for the chefs in the kitchen, especially in a town, right? known for its farm-to-fork capital moniker. That's where food purveyors come in. You probably are familiar with some of the big names like Sysco or US Foods, but there are also smaller family-owned operations like Sacramento-based Produce Express. It is a true mom and pop. It's been around for 36 years now. Scott Rose is the sales manager and joins us to help understand how this behind-the-scenes aspect of the restaurant industry is riding out the COVID period. And welcome, Scott. Nice to have you this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So when the pandemic first hit and restaurants were in full shutdown mode, your company decided to shift its produce distribution to a direct-to-consumer model. How did that work out?
We did, yeah. It was interesting, to be honest. You know, we don't, as a company, we really don't have a presence with the general public. They have no reason really to know who we are, because our customers are mainly restaurants.
Yeah.
And so the public doesn't really know who we are, but we wanted to do something. Grocery stores were having a hard time stocking their shelves. We saw other produce companies in California start a program where they were doing some boxes, and we kind of took that idea, kind of made it our own, and decided to offer almost a dozen different boxes, themed boxes, direct to consumers. And that we've been doing that now for I think since April.
And so you've stuck with it, and it's been popular.
It has, yeah. I'll be honest, it's not as popular today as it was when we first started, but right. I think that's really due to the fact that grocery stores are a little more stocked. Grocery stores are a little more organized today. There's not the long lines that you saw in the past. But we do. We still offer it 3 days a week. We have about half a dozen boxes that we offer at very reasonable, great pricing. They're all fresh produce, seasonal. They change rather often, depending on what's in season.
Yeah.
And that information can be... Mm-hmm.
I want to dig down on that a little bit, Scott. What is available? I know that earlier on, you were having a hard time getting some specialty products because... with all the restaurants closed, you know, not a lot right. of home cooks would use certain things that chefs might. So
right. the,
how's that playing out?
Demand plummeted for that. Yeah, the demand just went away for that kind of stuff. If you look at what the restaurants are offering today, most of it is, you know, it's comfort food. It's familiar. It's maybe things that are a little bit more elevated than what you would make at home or what you could make at home. But it's approachable. And so chefs kind of ditched the idea, not all. I mean, there are still some restaurants that are doing some, you know, really high-end curbside pickup type things. But for the most part, you know, people wanted, you know, asparagus and broccoli and carrots and potatoes and
right.
things that were relatively inexpensive and familiar to most.
Yeah, I can see that. What do you foresee going forward? I don't know if you got a chance to listen to my interview with Kate Washington just a moment ago.
I did.
I asked her, you know, How do you think all of this is going to change Sacramento's restaurant scene? What are you sensing? Because you're really in there talking to the chefs and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to be honest, what I'm seeing really is kind of a mixed bag. You have the restaurant closures, which are very unfortunate. Mm. You also see relative success with curbside and to-go meals. You also are seeing some restaurants really embracing the curbside and offering some really nice things. And on top of that, you're seeing some restaurants that are actually opening. I spoke to several chefs over the last week that are opening restaurants. There's restaurants opening up in K Street, Polanco. I spoke to the chef there yesterday.
Right, at Doko.
Polanco is supposed to, right, supposed to open soon. I know the Golden One Center is trying to put a program together to open some of their food kiosks and such.
What about pricing? Are restaurants ratcheting down pricing a bit? Because when, you know, if we just go back in time a year or so ago, prices were, you know, starting to sort of drift upward.
To be honest, I haven't seen that. And that's been a personal concern of mine. But you have to understand, too, that products today are harder to get. And because they're harder to get, they are a little bit more expensive. There is an additional cost that restaurants have today that they didn't have a few months ago. It's simply supply and demand. They're just, some items are not available, and they're harder to get. And, a lot of it has to do with transportation. Transportation companies don't like to send, trucks that are not full. So you have to wait, for product, and you have to pay a little bit more to get it.
Right. And when everything was really, you know, swimming along there, it was easy to fill those trucks and get something fresh to a restaurant in no time. Right. But that's just it's not the same picture anymore.
That is correct. And, you know, prior to COVID, the restaurant scene in Sacramento was booming.
Yeah.
We were set to have our best year in history. That all changed in mid-March. And
but you guys are doing OK. You know,
We're doing okay. Yeah. We're doing better than we were a few months ago.
Good.
I would say we're probably closer to about 70% of normal sales. Back in March and April, we were down to about 35 to 40. So things are looking up. And, you know, I'm glad that restaurants are able to offer some sort of dining outside and on patios and makeshift patios. And I like to see that.
Right on. Scott Rose is the sales manager for Produce Express. Thank you for giving us this kind of behind the scenes sort of situation. You're a former chef yourself, I should mention.
I am. Yeah. I spend a little time in the restaurant business here.
All right. Thank you, Scott. And speaking of changing restaurant scene, have you thought about buffets? So clearly, for obvious reasons, these have been shut down as cities, counties, and states work to protect against further coronavirus spread. So many buffets just aren't open. And a lot of them run by people of color, often as places where you can sample cuisines from India and other parts of Asia. But one city in our listening area is probably better known for their buffets than any other place. And it's Reno. I'm sure you guessed it ahead of time. For decades, casinos in Nevada have used those buffets as a lure to get gamblers through the doors. So what is to become of those massive spreads that have become a part of culture for many of us? Joining us from Reno now is Elizabeth Rose. Some of you may know that name as the midday host on Easy 104.1 FM, but her big claim to fame, at least in relationship to this segment, is as one of the administrators of the popular Reno Foodies Facebook page, which has more than 10,000 members and is one of those, you know, where you have to be a local to join. You can't just like pop in and join it. Welcome, Elizabeth. Great to have you on the show.
Good morning, Randall. How are you?
Good, thanks. So foodies, they can also like buffets. Those things don't have to be contradictory?
No, not necessarily. I talked to you a little bit yesterday when we chatted about the Atlantis. That is one of our larger buffets and best known, the Toucan Charlie's. And they about 3 years ago, they completely gutted and redid the place, and they're packed almost every night. But because of COVID, of course, they can't operate just as a buffet, like a cafeteria buffet where you serve yourself. Now there are servers behind the food, and you point at it and they will get it out for you. You do not touch any of the food there.
That happened to me on a cruise ship once when there was an outbreak of norovirus. And so I have a I have a sense of what you're talking about. So that one's open, but the majority of buffets in Reno right now are not?
Well, most of our buffets are in the casinos. Yeah. And the Peppermill is another big one. I'm not sure if that one's opened yet. A couple downtown have. Most of the casino restaurants have reopened. But of course, at 50% capacity, it's harder to get in to the nicer restaurants. You do have to make reservations these days. We've lost a few really good restaurants, but our food scene is surviving. Yeah, we are a foodie town here.
You are. And I do want to talk about that. The as a point of clarification for our California listeners, you can currently eat indoors in Reno and the rest of Nevada.
Yes, you can. Everybody's got to wear masks. You have to wear, if you are a patron, you must put on a mask to enter the establishment. And as soon as you get to your table, you can take it off. Of course, bar tops are closed, so you can only get table seating. Mm-hmm. And if you get up to, say, use the restroom, they want you to put your mask back on during that time that you are not actively sitting at the table.
So Reno's food scene, as you mentioned, was really taking off, much like Sacramento's, just hitting a high point when the pandemic hit. Reno also growing in population greatly over the last few years. You've seen it change a lot. You've been there for some time?
Yes, off and on for 40 years.
Wow, right. So do you expect it to bounce back, or do you expect to see some major changes when the pandemic gets under control?
As I said, we are losing some really good restaurants. They just couldn't do it anymore at 50% capacity. Most of our restaurant owners believe that they are meant to run at 90% capacity seating. And of course, that's good if you can do that. But right now you can't. And it's hurting a lot of people right now.
Because Reno's this melting pot of people from all over the place, is there a food that Reno's known for? You know how like San Francisco has its crab and sourdough, and Sacramento's
all you can eat sushi.
All you can eat, see, right? The buffet, the buffet style stuff. All you can eat sushi. So along those lines, some of the places like Indian buffets, Chinese food, all you can eat sushi. How are those faring right now?
We're not really big into the Chinese buffets, but we do have three really good Indian buffets, and they've gone to the same model as the Atlantis has. Mm. You get served by someone. You do not serve yourself.
But you still can get that selection, and I think that's what people like when they gravitate toward buffets. You know, not everyone can agree to eat at a certain place, but you're like, hey, there's this really large selection. You can have whatever you want.
That's the Atlantis.
So that's
it
still
is. They have half a dozen different cuisines. They've got the most beautiful dessert bar you've ever seen. They have a cotton candy bar.
Wow. How are things going in Sparks?
Sparks and Reno are basically one area. Mm-hmm. We're sister cities. We're right up against each other. And John Esquaga's Nugget is now just the Nugget, owned by Marnell Gaming. And their restaurants are coming back. They've opened a big, beautiful steakhouse on the downstairs level called Anthony's Chop House, and they are getting quite a bit of business down there.
Are you seeing places? It sounds like you're seeing new places open in the middle of all of this.
Not too many new places opening, but people are trying to expand. They're trying to follow through with the plans that they had before all this started.
All right. Elizabeth Rose, she is the administrator for the Reno Foodies Facebook page. It's not small, more than 10,000 people. If you're in the Reno area, you can join it. She's also a midday host on Easy 104.1 in Reno.
Actually, afternoons.
Oh, afternoons. I'm sorry. There we go. Afternoon host. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate you calling me.
You bet. You can find more about all of our guests and segments today at capradio.org/insight. I'm Randall White. Producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez helped out today. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Chris Vera Phillips. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. That's Insight for today. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
So that's today's deep dive look into one single topic from several different perspectives. Now for an in-depth conversation regarding the news of the day. Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Our big conversation today is about the restaurant industry and the massive toll the COVID-19 pandemic is taking on that sector of the economy. You know, the vast majority of us eat out, or at least we did, what, just 6 months ago. And because of that fact, restaurants are everywhere, whether it's chain establishments, fast food, or small locally owned spots. Every one of those businesses add up to one giant industry. In California alone, we're talking more than 1 in 10 jobs, with $97 billion in annual sales. That's according to the state's Restaurant Association. So coming up, we'll go behind the scenes for a look at where a lot of the fresh ingredients come from at Sacramento area eateries and how one locally owned provider has gotten creative to keep afloat. Also, why Black-owned restaurants did not get as much federal financial help early in the crisis. And you may have heard Sacramento's oldest restaurant is shuttering forever, just one of many casualties of the COVID shutdown. And what's the future for Reno's famous buffets? Will those shrines to gluttony ever return? But first up, there is a battle underway in the Sierra Foothills community where three restaurants are keeping their dining rooms open despite orders to shift to outdoor seating only. Nevada County supervisors met yesterday to decide how to handle the situation, and, well, a decision was made not to make a decision. Board Chair Heidi Hall joins us now to explain how that came to be and to talk a bit more about how important the restaurant and overall tourism economy is to Nevada County. Welcome to Insight, Supervisor Hall.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with yesterday's meeting. As I understand it, there were a lot of residents who wanted to comment supporting both sides of this issue regarding indoor dining.
Yeah. And let me just add that at the urgency ordinance that we were looking to pass was beyond indoor dining. It was about businesses in general and compliance with this overall health order in this time of a pandemic. So most of the counties are in the position where they need to pass some kind of an ordinance so they can properly work to fine businesses who aren't coming into compliance. You know, the tourism industry and restaurant industry is so huge for us that, of course, what we want is for all our businesses to come into compliance. And we've spent hours and days educating them and helping them get there. However, there are a couple who are intransigent, and there are other businesses also in the county who aren't complying. And so we needed a better tool to encourage them to come into compliance. This urgency ordinance that came before us, we'd actually created it about a month and a half ago, but we were doing really well on the COVID in terms, and our businesses were doing what they needed to, so we didn't bring it forward. It's become urgent. We brought it forward yesterday. We had almost 250 letters with comments, most of them asking us to pass the ordinance, but a substantial number also against it.
Heidi, I just want to, or Supervisor Hall, I just want to stop you there briefly to ask, what would be a normal number of letters that you would get for an issue before the supervisors?
Well, that's a good question. 5 or 10 or maybe 20. When we passed our cannabis regulations, we'd get, you know, 30 or 40 or 50. But so, this was a substantial.
Yeah, so that's a big deal. Number. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to like put that into perspective.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. So what we decided to do was to, my colleague asked me to pull the ordinance, my vice chair. And so out of respect for the folks who are feeling like their constituents didn't have enough information, we did that. We're going to spend the next 2 weeks getting more information out, explaining how it works. And we're going to bring it back on August 11th. And it's my hope at that time that we will pass it and make it easier for us to get those businesses into compliance.
In its current form, what does it say? What's sort of the teeth to it?
So it's an additional tool in the toolbox of enforcement. And again, just want to reiterate that what we do is education first, tons and tons of education. So right now what we do is we have, we've issued notices of violation. They start with $25 a day. They can double. The only next thing we can do besides finding these businesses right now is go to court and ask for a cease and desist order. That's cumbersome. It involves the courts. It's a big ratcheting up. Passing this urgency ordinance would allow us to start with fines of $1,000 a day. They can go up to $10,000. We'd hate to do that, but it's an administrative tool. So it gives us more ability to just continue to work with them and issue fines, work with a little bit faster, work with more people, and avoid, hopefully, this bigger ratcheting up.
So the restaurants in question, if I understand this correctly, are Old Town Cafe, Sergio's Cafe, and Friar Tux. Do I have that right?
That's correct, as of my knowledge. There are a few others that are coming in and out, and we keep hoping that one or two or all of these will come back into compliance before we have to do anything.
These three, are they owned by the same group or people, or are they unified?
They are owned by individual owners, completely separate from one another. However, there is a sort of an outside agitator who's come into town and rallied them to try to push back on the county, suggesting that we're violating their constitutional rights. So they are kind of working together right now.
And during yesterday's supervisors meeting, some of the people that were arguing in favor of keeping these dining rooms opened had some virus skepticism. But at that point, you brought in interim public health officer Dr. Richard Johnson. What did he have to say?
Well, yes, skepticism is a nice word. There's a lot of sense of that this is all a hoax and that it's an attempt to take over control. Some pretty extreme ideas and thoughts out there. Our interim health officer made it pretty clear that this is not a hoax, that herd immunity really isn't something we can count on right now. And that, as we've been hearing from every scientist and public health official for months now, the only things we can do right now to slow this virus is to wear masks, socially distance, and wash our hands. And indoor dining, you know, is shut down in the entire state of California. And that's because it's too hard to do those things.
You mentioned that indoor dining is shut down throughout the state. So why is this in the county's hands? Can the state not step in? Should the state step in to have these restaurants move their dining entirely outdoors?
I'm not aware that the state has any role in this. The Alcohol and Beverage Control Agency does, and they have become interested also. They would potentially pull liquor licenses, which would be very expensive for these restaurants. You know, it's the local control piece of it is a mixed bag. We want to keep that local control so that we can work with our restaurants. We have a phenomenal environmental health director, and she spent, they visited every single restaurant, 5, 4, 5, 6, some of them 8, 9, 10 times to try to bring them into compliance. So that gives us, keeping some local control there keeps us the ability to really work closely with our restaurants. We're all a small community. You know, we all know each other. We are all right. Family. So we really try to work well with them. But, you know, we have concerns about this outside agitation that's happening up there.
Supervisor Hall, you mentioned to me in a phone call the other day when we were sort of getting to know each other that the board there, the Board of Supervisors, has a range of political positions. But you've But during this crisis, you've really come together and been a unified force. But issues like this can put a strain on that unification. How is it going right now?
That's such an excellent point. And I have to say, this board has been amazing throughout this year and throughout my term. We've worked really well together. We are across the political spectrum. We have political differences, but our number one concern is what is right for the county. And we recognize that we need to protect our residents from this pandemic and that our businesses are absolutely critical. So this is going to be a very painful vote for all of us, because no one wants to see any businesses shut down, but we are doing everything we can to support them. We've put together a Nevada County Relief Fund, and we're putting $100,000 in that to help our small businesses. Our CARES Act funding, we're going to turn around and put 30% of that money back into helping our businesses. So we are agreeing on doing everything we can to help them. And we have to agree on doing what is going to be right for this county as well.
Supervisor Hall, help us understand Nevada County. It is geographically spread out, with a couple of different population centers. The whole area does share a common reliance on tourism, but give us a good picture of Nevada County for those of us that, you know, really don't have a concept of it.
Absolutely. I always love to talk about my county. We're small. We're just under 100,000 people, excuse me, in the Sierra foothills total. We're in the Sierra foothills. We have a couple of small cities, Grass Valley and Nevada City on the west side, slightly larger city, still small, of Truckee on the east side, which shares a border with Placer County. So that gets, you know, connected to a slightly different economy up there. Mm-hmm. Our businesses, I would say, outside of our hospital and government centers, almost every other business is a small business. We rely on tourism. We have worked really well together as a community. We have these historic Victorian hotels that are being renovated, beautiful B&Bs, a wonderful, quite stunning music and arts centers and culture, lots of restaurants that are well-known, and lots of wonderful boutiques. So they've worked really well together to make coming up to Nevada County an experience, just the whole thing. You come up for one thing and you do all the rest. And we're a community that stands up for each other. We've come together over the power shutdowns, over wildfire issues, and we've really come together around this issue as well.
So I imagine this is a really odd situation to be in, where you have all of these tourist amenities, as you just mentioned, yet bringing in tourists from outside the area could also bring the virus.
Absolutely. It's a concern we have. It's a balance we're trying to make. And I'll have to say, shout out to our cities, all three of them, who have bent over backwards also to be creative. So for example, downtown Grass Valley immediately put up barriers in the middle of the streets, planted planters, brought in picnic tables from the fairgrounds to make it easier for those restaurants who have to close indoors to expand their businesses outdoors.
And this is where those three restaurants are, right, on that stretch?
Two of them are there.
Two of them, okay.
The other one is in Nevada City. And I went in Nevada City this weekend, and I went to four other establishments that are doing it right, and they were packed. They were booked for the night. So we know it's possible to survive in these circumstances, although it is very difficult. And, you know, we're just trying to pull together to get through it together. And it is a little disturbing to have these agitating influences that really don't seem to have our best interest as a county at heart.
Finally, Supervisor Hall, I have to ask how the meeting went yesterday, being virtual, when you have such a turnout of people wanting to have their voices heard. Would you call that a success?
I actually would, because we've been doing Zoom meetings now for a couple of months, and people have gotten used to all the ways they can provide comment. We have a phone line, we have a comment line, and we have emails. The fact that we got over 250 letters and people knew to get them in before 5 o'clock that night or by 8 o'clock in the morning, and we got as many as we did, I think it's working. It's clearly not ideal. We'd love to get back in the chambers and have people see our faces and have us see their faces. But I think we've worked it out to make it work fairly well for now.
wouldn't it be nice to get back to normal?
Oh, just, my gosh.
Even when it comes to like just attending a supervisor's meeting, right?
So, exactly.
Chair for the Nevada County Board of Supervisors, Heidi Hall, thank you for insight into the situation that's going on up there right now on several different levels.
Thank you so much. And we hope people will come back up and visit us when things are easier.
All right, Supervisor Heidi Hall, up next. Black-owned restaurants did not get as much federal financial help earlier in the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll speak with a journalist who's following that story. Also, we'll be joined by Sacramento Bee food critic Kate Washington. Her take on what's working and what's not as restaurants in the area try to cope with the shifting landscape of coronavirus protections. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.